What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you very much, Scott, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Deirdre Bosa, in for Kelly Evans, and here is what's ahead. Satori Fund's Dan Niles, he is here with the three names he would kick out of the Mag 7 and the names and areas beyond big cap tech where he is seeing opportunity right now. Plus, as we are gearing up for bank earnings, we are checking in with someone who runs a bank and has helped run some of the biggest tech and fintech companies. She's looking to transform the banking industry. Jackie Reses is here to tell us how. And ahead of CPI tomorrow, inflation concerns not slowing down Norwegian's plans to expand. The company just placed its biggest ship order ever. The CEO will join us live with the details and what he is seeing from the consumer. But we begin with today's markets. Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom.
All right. So, Dee, inflation concerns, as you point out, are part of the market narrative right now ahead of those inflation figures coming out later on this week. And we are seeing a decidedly more negative tone to the markets right now. They were positive at one point today, but the benchmark S&P 500 is at 5185, which is down about 17 points, one-third of 1% declines there. At the high point today, we were actually up 22 points on the session, down roughly 42 at the lows. So again, well off the session lows, but still decidedly negative. The Dow Industrial is down 150-some points, one-half of 1% declines there, 38,739 the last trade there. And the Nasdaq Composite, 16,233, off about 21 points, leading, if you will, or not lagging by as much, only down about one-tenth of 1% there. On those inflationary concerns, two key parts of the market right now in focus. One of them is in gold prices, a traditional safe haven trade, one that's also been seen as an inflation hedge. If you take a look at gold futures right now, up about 16.5%, 2384.50. That is your new high watermark for that blue line. So again, 2384.50. And that represents a new, again, record high for gold prices. It's been up 3 days in a row and 10 out of the last 11. Gold mining stocks, though, still over the course of the last year, down about 1%, but they've been picking up some steam over the course of the last couple of months with those highs in gold prices. And another part to watch as well is energy prices, a part of the market that a lot of folks say is a key barometer for the health of the overall economy, what's going on. Crude oil prices taking a bit of a dip today, but still up about 5% over the last year. The energy sector up 12% in that span, but it's right here on this year-to-date period where it really stands out. Those energy sector stocks, D, they're the second best performing sector in the S&P 500 in 2024, second only to communication services and even slightly higher than technology. So watch that energy trade. D, I'll send things back.
Yeah, and Dom, our next guest is one of those people that believes it's an important barometer. Oil, of course, has been moving higher even before the recent escalation of tensions in the Middle East, up nearly 20% year to date. My next guest says energy prices are actually the most important economic data point that he's watching, given its impact on consumer spending and inflation. For more on how he is positioning against this backdrop, let's bring in Dan Niles, founder and portfolio manager of the Satori Fund. Dan, great to have you with us. Talk a little bit more about this potential impact. Does it complicate a soft landing narrative?
I mean, it does and it doesn't. On the negative side, it obviously goes ahead and feeds into inflation. So, you know, you transport all your stuff to your grocery store, you fill up your gas tank, you heat your home. So that's a bad thing for the inflation numbers that are coming out. But the Fed's also, to some degree, part of the reason inflation is as high as it is the consumer is incredibly strong. And you could argue maybe that's left over from all the stimulus during COVID. But it's also going to destroy some consumer demand because you are spending more at the pump and you are spending more for milk and eggs, et cetera. So I think it's a push-pull on that. But I think it feeds into the narrative that the economy is pretty strong. And it's just one of the things you're going to have to deal with.
So, Dan, when do you start to worry if we see oil stay at these prices or go even higher?
Well, I mean, I think you kind of look to the markets to understand that. But I think you're going to get an important gut check coming up when you get earnings that start in earnest later this week with the big banks and then really kick in the week after. But you've already heard from some companies that have reported already that are off quarter in the retail space, that it is starting to, whatever it is it's starting to affect the lower end of their consumer base. And so that's something I'm definitely paying attention to, especially as we get into earnings in earnest next week for the
Dan, it takes some time for the impact of these higher commodity prices to trickle through into the inflation data. Do you think that investors should start to worry that this commodities rally could set back the Fed's plan to cut interest rates? When do they start worrying about that?
Well, I mean, they already started worrying when the payroll numbers came out last week. You came in at 300,000 jobs. People were looking for 200,000. Obviously, the bond market sold off. The Fed rate cuts, I think, is a coin flip between 2 to 3 rate cuts at this point. I'm thinking it's probably closer to 1 to 2, because unless you see energy prices drop a lot or the economy slow down a lot, you're going to probably see those expectations getting ratcheted back. But don't forget, this whole year, those expectations have been coming down. We started the year at about 6 rate cuts. It was peaked at about 7. We're now down to between 2 to 3, and the S&P gained 10% in the first quarter. That's fantastic. Right. It's better than the for a typical year. So I think you've been sort of ignoring this along the path. Our main thing is we're just trying to stay flexible, focus on the companies that we think will put up great numbers regardless, that are more focused on the election coming up, and then trying to avoid the more consumer-facing ones.
And even when Kashkari put the potential of 0 rate cuts on the table, markets have been fairly resilient. We're going to get into that in just a moment. Stay with us, Dan. 3-year Treasury notes are up for auction. Rick Santelli tracking the action at the CME. Over to you, Rick.
Yes, Deidre, it has been a big start to an auction. This, of course, is the first leg of $119 billion in supply with $58 billion 3-year notes. We've never had an auction bigger than $58 billion, but in 2021, we had many auctions that were equal to $58 billion. The yield at this auction, 4.548. Was the when issued market, the minute the bidding ended, 4.528. It tailed 2 full basis points. Now, to be fair, the market's been rallying. The when issued market yields were dropping pretty much all morning, just like yields in regular fully traded treasuries. But the fly in the ointment is we didn't trade up at 4.548 where the result was for probably 40 minutes. So even though it rallied, it still didn't price well. And all the other metrics were basically below 10 auction average. Generically, most of them were the weakest since December of last year, so not that long. But the point is, 2 basis point tail, you look at an intraday of 3s, you look at where we've been and how we came into this week with yields starting to fall as we go into the big CPI number, but there's no getting around D+. It was a very, very weak first leg of an auction, and even though the market's rallying make it that much more difficult to move the paper at a higher yield, it still really does demonstrate that investors were laying back a bit with no doubt an eye towards tomorrow's possibility of any surprises on the consumer price index. Deirdre, back to you.
We'll be watching that closely. Thank you, Rick. Dan, I just want to come to you on bond yields. We were talking about market resilience, and they have been so far, but we haven't seen quite as much resilience, arguably, in the last, let's call it, week and a half, right? Does that signify a bigger shift in market sentiment or character for the remaining year?
Yeah, I mean, I think here's the thing. I lived through the tech bubble, and you had a lot of sharp corrections along the way to that big increase. And is it going to surprise me to see that? I mean, obviously, NVIDIA is down over 10% from its 52-week high, but I think there's a lot more room to grow. And I think the key really comes down to earnings. If I have to pick between more rate cuts because the economy is slower, which means less earnings growth, or the exact opposite, which is the economy remains stronger so companies can put up decent numbers, I'd rather pick that scenario, because ultimately earnings is what drives stock prices over the long term. Obviously, over the short term, it's all sentiment driven. It has nothing to do with stock prices. But over the long term, that's what's going to drive these things. And with the runs that these stocks have had from their lows, if you get earnings disappointments, you are absolutely going to get crushed. And to some degree, you saw that with Tesla delivery numbers, where people are expecting a bad number, you got a bad number, and the stock got hit the next day anyway. And so I kind of use that as a tell for probably how earnings season is going to go, where you're not going to get away with saying, yeah, things are bad this quarter, next quarter, but, you know, like 2 years from now, it's going to be wonderful. I don't think that's going to fly like it did last year.
It's a great point. I've been wondering the same thing, whether Tesla was sort of a canary in the coal mine or it's just Tesla, which trades uniquely. Dan, stay there. We're going to delve into some of these more individual names. Amazon shares, so let's drill down on them. They have nearly doubled off of their recent low, and they're closing in on a new all-time intraday high. Kate Rooney with the details. Kate.
Hey there, Debo. There has been a lot of love for Amazon lately. We've seen a handful of price target increases and calls reaffirming it as one of Wall Street's highest conviction picks. The average target has climbed to $209. That applies about a 13% upside to where shares are trading now. Sell-side firms are overwhelmingly bullish. 95% now have the equivalent of a buy rating. There's three holds, no sell ratings out there on Amazon. As RBC puts it, it's one of the internet's largest true alpha dogs, thanks to its scale in e-commerce and then its cloud business, also a top pick for Morgan Stanley. They lay out what they call better cost to serve and efficiency upside. They also point to Prime driving recurring revenue, cloud adoption hitting an inflection point, and advertising potential. Jefferies, for its part, says still plenty to be excited about and plenty of runway ahead for Amazon. While it's outperformed all but NVIDIA in the Mag 7 this year, it's up about 20%. AI really has been the big story for other big tech companies. Very few mentions of artificial intelligence as any sort of catalyst for Amazon stock. Jefferies warns that Amazon needs to improve its AI offering to stay competitive as multi-cloud adoption grows. The big downside risk to Amazon would be any sort of threat to its golden goose, AWS. Slowing revenue or margins declining would be a weight on shares. There's also threats in e-commerce from the likes of Shein and Temu, and investors are watching the economic backdrop as well. Dee, back to you.
Kate Rooney, thank you very much. And 188.65, that is the record high number to watch for Amazon. Meantime, Alphabet has already hit a new all-time high today. Dan, I wonder if you could compare those two stocks for me. Part of what Kate was saying is that there's a lot of reasons to like Amazon, but AI isn't necessarily one of them seen on the street. And while people have sort of knocked Google for its AI narrative, it has a lot of the technology, developed a lot of the technology here. How do you place them when you're just looking at their generative AI propositions?
Well, I would disagree with the fact that people aren't focused on AI for AWS, because if you think about it, they are the biggest player in the outsourced cloud market. They have about a third of that market share. And when companies want to host their AI apps, the first place they're going to go look at is Amazon. And you've seen that with Amazon Web Services in the sense that the growth rate slowed from about 40% year over year in the fourth quarter of 2021. It dropped all the way down to 12% in the second and third quarter, and then accelerated slightly in the second and third quarter, it dropped down to 12%, and then accelerated to 13% going forward. And now we'll see what they say for March. And I think you're going to see some acceleration there. That's going to be helpful to them going forward. The bigger thing I'm positive on is the retail business, because they overbuilt capacity during COVID. We all then went out and wanted to go to real stores. They had too much capacity. Now they're filling that up at very low cost. And so you get big margin improvement. So I see the EPS doubling from calendar 23 to calendar 25 on a GAAP basis. Right. And, you know, as I said earlier, earnings ultimately drive stock prices. And so that's why Amazon and Meta both were two of my top five picks entering this year. And I still feel good about both.
Yeah, that profitability piece has been really fascinating to watch. But those are the retail margins. And I wonder if going forward, it's all going to be about that AI proposition. And, you know, my understanding that it's all about openness and choice. And when you look to Google, they've got the most choice. And you even see Citadel Securities moving its data and algorithm testing to Google Cloud. So if the next leg of this race is taking place, who's best positioned? Is it AWS or is it a Google Cloud?
Well, you got to remember, though, Deirdre, the big thing for Google, like, we can focus on the AI side of it, but don't forget, they have 93% share in search. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you can't say, well, all these companies are doing this great job in AI, whether it's Perplexity or Microsoft or OpenAI, et cetera. And then look at Google with 93% share and go, well, something's got to give. And that's their golden goose is search. And don't forget, last quarter, they missed their search revenue numbers, they missed their YouTube revenue numbers, and they missed their owned and operated numbers on the top line. So you can't kind of have it both ways. And that's why for Google, I'm sort of watching and waiting to see what happens. And especially when your accuracy of the results you get back when you're using their product isn't particularly good.
Yep, you bring up a good point. It's that innovator's dilemma, right, which a lot of Wall Street is looking at. If it can't disrupt its own search business, does it leave it open for disruption? It's a great point. Kind of last question for you, Dan. When we look towards the earnings season, how are you thinking about the Magnificent Seven, which carried the market, or even the Fab Four, if you want to eliminate a few of them, versus the rest of the market this year when we've seen a broadening out? Do you think that lasts?
I think it 100% lasts. And, you know, back to the Tesla thing and your comment that was it a canary in the coal mine? I think you're 100% right in that it was a canary in the coal mine. Expectations were really low. They missed those, but the stock still went down. Where last year, Tesla's estimates, don't forget, were coming down by 50% last year, and the stock went up 100%. Same thing with Apple. Apple estimates were coming down all year last year. The stock was up 40%. That's not what you've seen so far in 2024, where both Apple's down over 10%, Tesla's down over 30%. And I think that's going to continue as we get into earnings season. Bank results on Friday, that might be something that gives us a tell as well to see how the rest of the earnings season
shapes up. I was just going to ask, where are you looking outside of mega cap? Is it bank earnings? What do you want to see when they start reporting this week?
I just want to see the reaction to bank earnings, because to me, that's going to be very telling for the rest of earnings season. But to your point, I'm very bullish on four out of the, or I call them the Fantastic Four, because I'm a superhero fan, but I'm very bullish on those four. I'm pretty negative on Tesla and Apple and Google. And that's kind of how I've got this weighting set up right now, because to your point, as you said earlier, the market's kind of going sideways here for the last week or so. And I want to stay with the names where I think numbers can go higher. And I'm also trying to bet on the presidential election just being the most contentious we've ever seen. Lots of ad dollars flowing in, and that should help Meta and a lot of the companies in that vein. So that's where I'm trying to set up how I'm thinking about the world right now with my investments.
Are you looking beyond those mega caps, though? Are you looking a layer down some of the cloud applications? What about semis? They've still had a good run to begin this year.
Yeah, you're right. I'm looking outside of tech. So I've got investments that I'm looking at, I already have, in industrials, in fintech, in biotech. And so I'm really trying to move outside of tech, because I feel like in this whole AI euphoria that's happened, which is rightly deserved, because I do think it's going to change the way we all live, much like the internet did in the mid-90s. A lot of these other sectors have sort of been forgotten about. And so that's kind of where we're looking for different investment themes.
And by the way, we'll be impacted by AI and generative AI as well. Dan Niles, thank you very much for being with us today. Always appreciated. By the way,
my pleasure.
Do not miss my exclusive interview with Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian tomorrow right here on The Exchange at 1 p.m. Eastern. And still ahead, one money manager warned investors about Apple and Tesla when he was on our show 6 weeks ago. Since then, they're the only two of the Mag 7 stocks that are lower. But are they cheap enough to buy yet? We'll ask him next. Plus, what effect with the Fed's higher for longer mantra, what effect will that have on the financials? We will ask banking veteran Jackie Reese about that. And the future of fintech, The Exchange is back right after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Even with last week's pullback, my next guest says the record run in stocks can continue as long as earnings deliver. And he has four names in four different sectors he sees well-positioned for gains from here. Joining me now is Michael Landsberg, CIO at Landsberg Bennett Private Wealth Management. Michael, thanks for being with us. So we had a very good first quarter. Where does the market go from here?
Deidre, I think, you know, I'm excited that the market seems to be trading on earnings. You know, we had a lot of this expectations about the Fed intervening, and that was kind of distorting, I think, what was really going on fundamentally. But last, you know, first quarter, we had 8% year-over-year S&P 500 earnings growth, over 30% in the NASDAQ. And I think that's a strong determining factor of what's going to go on. Earnings drive stocks, certainly in intermediate and longer term, and that's what we're focusing on.
Isn't that a little to be determined? It feels like over the last few weeks, stocks have reacted more to Fed speak, the potential number of rate cuts, commodity prices. How can we tell already that it's trading on earnings?
Well, I think the first quarter traded on earnings. Certainly, okay, the Fed speak has gotten involved with where we are. And unfortunately, what happens is in the short term, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of dislocation in the market because of, you know, a speech here, an off word said by one of the Fed governors somewhere else. But at the end of the day, longer-term investors need to focus on earnings. Certainly, the short-term stuff is going to play itself out.
I was just talking to our previous guest, Dan Niles, at the start of the show. I'm not sure if you heard that, but he was pointing to Tesla delivery numbers and how the stock reacted pretty strongly and whether that might be a canary in the coal mine. Do you think that expectations are high going into earnings and any stumble could throw off markets, especially from the big tech companies?
I think Tesla's a little bit different in that Tesla, we've been negative on Tesla for, you know, over a year. The EV market is not as strong as, you know, as many people think. The Chinese have certainly, you know, gone ahead of Tesla. So I don't look at Tesla as really a market, a harbinger of what's going to go on. I look at the rest of the market and say there's a lot of growth going on. I think NVIDIA's numbers are way more important to what's going to go on than certainly Tesla. And that ecosystem that NVIDIA has kind of grown itself around AI, that's way more important than something like Tesla that I think is, you know, kind of 2 years ago story.
Right. And you say that NVIDIA is attractively priced for investors, not traders. Explain that. You need to have a longer time horizon.
Absolutely. I think if you look at today and go, boy, the PE on this is really high, their earnings growth is so strong that if I look a couple of years out and say, if I want to hold this for 2 or 3 years, the multiple is not very high because their earnings growth is that exponential, at least at this point. I mean, everybody on the street was basically off by 50% last year in terms of how much earnings they really did. So they continue at a very good clip.
Right.
I think we're going to look at 26 and 27 and go, boy, NVIDIA was pretty cheap back in 2024.
It's been amazing to watch that price to earnings ratio change with their numbers and their quarterly results. Let's get beyond tech, though. We did so with Dan Niles as well, and he's looking outside of the Mag 7 and tech as a whole. And you've got some picks in auto and industrials. Tell us about them.
Yeah, I like O'Reilly Automotive. It's kind of the anti-tech play. Everybody's got to fix their car. They've got a nice balance between do-it-yourselfers and commercial. So I think they're not relying on one or the other. But, you know, cars break, and people need to fix their cars. They've always been a good operator. It's basically a two-person show. I think AutoZone and O'Reilly are the two best in breed. We favor O'Reilly because of, you know, growth and as well as valuation. But I think it's a good story that continues to go on. It's not going to be outsourced by AI. You're going to be fixing your own car and your own truck or vehicle. So I think it's a good spot to be. Again, PE is very realistic in terms of their growth.
Right, more of a value pick. Tell me about Rheinmetall, too, an auto and defense company.
Yeah, Rheinmetall is actually a German defense company. They're in auto, but for the most part, what we're looking at is a way to be able to play kind of the restocking of munitions all across Europe because of what's going on in Ukraine. So what's going to happen, and they got a contract actually in the last couple of weeks from the German government, you're seeing more and more money being spent on kind of replacing some of the things that are being used in this war over there. I don't see the war necessarily going away. This is a way for us to be able to play something locally, much better valuations than U.S. defense companies, but they're right on the ground very close, and so they can get supplies to Ukraine more quickly. I think that's the way that the governments of Europe are going to start giving supplies as opposed to dollars to the Ukraine situation.
Well, thanks for being with us, Michael. Appreciate your insights. Michael Landsberg. Coming up, Muni credit is the best it's been in 20 years, according to PIMCO, but some areas are starting to see a peak. We will ask the new co-head of the firm's Muni bond team where. That's up next.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update this hour. Former President Trump lost a bid to delay his April 15th hush money trial this morning while he appeals a gag order in the case. An appeals court judge made that ruling, and barring any more court action, it means jury selection will begin next week. Trump also lost a last-minute attempt to delay the trial by requesting a change of venue from Manhattan. Jennifer and James Crumley, parents of the Oxford, Michigan school shooter, were both sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison this afternoon on four counts of involuntary manslaughter. They are the first parents ever to be charged and convicted in their child's mass shooting. And Mount Etna is putting on a show, spitting out smoke rings in the skies over Sicily. They are technically called volcanic vortex rings, rare but natural, nearly perfect circles of gas. Mount Etna, known to emit more than any other volcano on Earth, inspiring locals to rename it the Lady of the Rings. Let's send it out to Rick Santelli now for Muni Money. Rick.
Yes, Tyler, Muni Money indeed, and we have a special guest today, David Hammer. He's PIMCO head of Muni Portfolio, and I'd like to welcome David Hammer. David, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Rick. Thanks for having me.
All right. So as we heard Deirdre point out, one of the best landscapes in the muni space in 20 years. You've talked many times, as we've discussed today, that many players are starting to step away for a variety of reasons, like banks and high interest rates and what it's doing to their portfolios in different ways. So as they step away, is this void worth stepping into?
Yeah, it is. You know, the best credit conditions in 20 years, it's driven by expectations a few years ago during the pandemic that tax collections would decline by 10 to 20%. Federal relief was crafted based on that expectation. But in reality, tax collections, sales tax, property tax, income taxes, they're up 25 to 30%. It's been a big improvement to Muni Credit. But while fundamentals have improved, many investors, to your point, have really stepped back from the market. 2022 and 2023 and combined a record outflow period. Very little of that money has come back to the muni market, a different story than investment grade corporate credit or high yield corporate credit or institutional investors have been quick to come back. U.S. investors have been slower, and that means higher yields and wider spreads than other markets.
Now we have April 15th coming up, David, April 15th, and everybody understands that's tax time. Does that mean anything special for muni investing? Is it some type of seasonal anomaly that occurs when people liquidate parts of their portfolios to pay their taxes?
Yeah, this is typically a seasonally very weak time of the year. Investors pull money out of their muni allocation to go pay their federal tax bill coming up in a week or so here. And at the same time, we tend to see a big increase in supply. And that's happened this year. It's pushed spreads a little bit wider, in addition to just interest rates going higher. So relative to the peak of a few months ago, major indices are down about 1.5 to 2%. This tends to be a pretty good time to allocate to munis. And I think, you know, tax efficiency, it's top of mind for investors today. Another thing that we're really recommending our clients do is look at their muni allocations and think about harvesting tax losses. It's a good time to consider locking in some of those losses, moving up in tax-free yield. And we see a lot of opportunities to do that in today's market, especially more active strategies that have more actively managed their dividends relative to passive
ones. You know, it's always about risk-reward, David. It's always about risk-reward. And you're telling me how to get some better reward. How does that risk parameter, and just go over it superficially, but if you had to look at taxable securities versus muni securities in a risk profile when you want to step up maybe to lower grade of investment grade, how does that fare?
Yeah, so we really like allocations that take advantage of the steep yield curve and not rated bonds that we consider higher quality, high yield. A well-structured portfolio, you can earn about 5% tax-free with a low investment grade rating today. an investor would have to earn about 8.25% pre-tax to get the same after-tax return. And outside of the muni market, that means taking a lot more risk. So we like the return profile. We like the yield. We also like the downside in the event that the economy does slow more than what's expected. Investors are better protected in asset class that historically has much lower default rates.
Now, real quickly, we're almost out of time. Passive portfolios are easy. You know, you buy the ETF, it's on autopilot. But if you have an active portfolio manager that you like, you usually get better results. What do you like? What do you prefer? And what are the opportunities in more of an active approach?
Yeah, I'd start with the curve. The muni curve is upward sloping, about 125 basis points of additional yield moving out from 10 years to 30 years. Very different than other asset classes where yield curves are flat to inverted. So we like a barbell strategy where investors run a lot of shorter term munis, marry that with a longer term allocation, get about the same duration profile as a more passive index with a pickup of 50 to 100 basis points in tax-free yield. In addition to that, some of the not rated segments of the market that I mentioned, specifically assets that are repaid through property taxes. There's been a big increase in house price appreciation over the last few years. That's just starting to flow through to assessed values in property taxes. So we really see a multi-year tailwind in some of those credits.
Excellent, David. Thank you for joining me today. I definitely look at the yield curve, and I try to weigh all investments, as many viewers do. And there's definitely opportunities in the muni space. The taxable side of it versus more tax-free in munis certainly presents big opportunity. Thank you for joining us today. Deirdre, back to you.
And thanks to you, Rick Santelli, and your guest, David Hammer. Let's get a quick check on shares of Boeing. They're off by about 2% on the heels of earlier reports that the FAA is investigating claims by a Boeing whistleblower about flaws in the 787 Dreamliner. Senator Blumenthal now reportedly holding a hearing next Wednesday with a Boeing whistleblower on the company's safety culture. We'll continue to watch that story. Coming up, banks are off to a strong start this year, but can that run continue into earnings season? We will ask banking veteran Jackie Reese's next. Plus, Norwegian Cruise Lines just announced its largest order ever for 8 new ships over the next 12 years. What's driving the investment and what's the risk of oversupply? We will ask the CEO later on in the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. We are just a few days away from the unofficial start of earnings season with JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi. They will all report on Friday. My next guest runs a bank, and as a former executive at Square, Yahoo, Alibaba, and Goldman Sachs, she has a unique perspective on the industry, especially the intersection of finance and technology. Joining me now in an exclusive interview is Jackie Reese's, co-founder and CEO of Lead Bank. Jackie, thanks for being with us in person.
Oh, of course.
Well.
Happy to.
So most economists are still looking for a soft landing or no recession. What does loan growth look like in this kind of environment as we get ready for the bank earnings?
Yeah, so we've had muted loan growth for obvious reasons because of the rise in interest rates. I think we've had this unusual environment where we've had incredible unemployment numbers. We've actually had a pretty benign level of credit defaults. And so it's been a pretty robust environment for banking in general, with the one exception of loan growth, because we've been sitting here with such high interest rates for so long. So I think we're now at the point where there's expectations of a rate decline. I think the Fed is reluctant to move too quickly so that we don't see an environment where they maybe make a mistake by a quarter or two.
Right.
So we're sitting here towards the end of the year, and then we have expectations that rates would decline, and you would expect to see some acceleration of loan growth.
On the other side of that, right, is net interest income, and higher rates are more beneficial for that. So how do higher for longer rates, what's the full impact of that?
Well, we've seen that over the course of the last few years where banks have performed well as it relates to net interest margin, which is one of their main metrics for performance. You know, what you typically see is that loan books reprice faster than deposit books. And so banks have benefited off of the changes in interest rates that we've seen for the last few years.
Right. Last time I saw you was just a few weeks ago in San Francisco on the anniversary of Silicon Valley Bank's implosion. We talked about that. What's your view on the health of regional and community banks right now? Are they out of the woods?
Well, we've seen this mass amount of deposit movement into two areas. One is, you know, money markets, and I think that's a structural change that's happened to the banking industry. And the second is a move from small banks and regional banks to big money center banks. I think the top 15 banks hold about 76% of the deposits in the United States, the top four banks have almost 50% of the deposits. And I think we've got a real structural shift that happened in the United States as a result of SVB that I don't think is coming back. I think each regional bank has to figure out their own strategy for how they try to win back some of that deposit growth in order to obviously have the deposits to do the other side of the balance sheet, which is lend the money out in their communities.
Right. At Lead Bank, you have sort of another business as well. You serve local customers, but you've also built an on-ramp for financial technology companies. Is that in response to sort of the aggregation we're seeing at the bigger banks?
It's not in response. I mean, we do have a really healthy community bank in Kansas City, Missouri, that we're really proud of. We have amazing customers, amazing board members, but we run a fintech infrastructure company. We build all kinds of banking products and APIs for consumer companies and tech companies that want to embed banking services into their business. And so that's a business we've seen a lot of small banks pursue over time because they're exempt from the Durbin laws. So they're able to build products that have differentiated opportunities with regard to interchange. But we are seeing an environment where folks like us are seeing all kinds of regulatory challenges in the market. We are having an incredible opportunity as a result of that. Right. You know, there's an incredible flight to quality. And so at Lead, we're certainly benefiting from that dynamic in the market.
A lot of these fintechs arose, raised money, built their businesses in very different times. And you say that the last few years has driven a reexamination of quality of partner that fintechs work with. Is that raising the risk behind the scenes?
No, it should be mitigating the risk, thankfully. Okay. And I think the regulators like the FDIC and the OCC are being more aggressive about how they pursue the partnerships between fintechs and banks. Most people don't realize that fintechs operate on the rails of the banking system. I think that keeps us all safe and sound because the rules of banking and the regulations around banking have been established for almost 100 years now. And so what ends up happening is that a lot of these banks that started to get into the business with fintechs were really out over their skis. Mm. They cropped up, they built a partnership. You have these mass consumer companies in fintech that have aggregated tens of millions of customers with bank infrastructure underneath that's not fit for the scale and velocity of the transactions happening. And so folks like us at Lead Bank, we understand technology, but we also, at the front and center of our strategy, are able to be safe, sound, work with companies that are the best in the industry who want to scale with a heavily compliant, strong type of environment because they know they have to be front and center in this regulatory environment.
Speaking of disruption, you know, in San Francisco, a lot of people talk about financial services as being an area, industry ripe for artificial intelligence and generative AI. Who do you think is leading the way right now? Is it the big banks or is it some of the smaller fintech players?
Well, I think they've all used AI in some form for the last 10 years. You've seen any kind of financial institution use machine learning models. They use it in fraud, they use it in customer support, customer acquisition, and even algorithmic lending, which I would say the fintechs were probably stronger at than a lot of the banks.
So what about Gen AI? Can they harness that?
Well, so they can in everything except for credit at this point, because credit has fair lending standards. I think the biggest thing that has to happen around AI is that you have to be able to backtest it. And if you can't backtest it, you have to be able to prove that you're in compliance with some of the lending laws. The interesting thing with AI is that it's unbounded. And so you've seen this environment where you're able to actually do math around some of the changes in platform shifts in technology. But AI is the one recent change in technology that you can't do math on. The opportunity is all upside. And you've yet to see it really permeate the entire economy. And I would liken it to the way the internet, at the time when the internet started, you couldn't do math on looking at what the size of the market transition is. And AI is the same, if not bigger, because of the expectations of what's going to change as a result of it.
And you were on the front lines of the last shift as well. So, Jackie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Jackie Reses of Lead Bank. By the way, Jackie is one of CNBC's changemakers, and there's still time to register for the inaugural summit in New York City on April 18th, where you can hear from some of the women transforming business. To request an invite, just scan that QR code on your screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers.
Coming up, this name hit an intraday high of more than $75 when it started trading 2 weeks ago. Shares are down about 26% since then. We will reveal it, so make your guesses now and check on some of the day's other big movers. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Trump Media. That was the mystery chart that we showed you before the break, hitting its lowest level since going public via SPAC 2 weeks ago. It has been volatile. Corporate filings, which revealed the company's net loss of $58 million last year on revenue of just $4 million, also show exactly how much of its executives are being paid in stock and compensation. For that full story, head over to CNBC.com. Coming up on the show, cruise stocks getting hit today. Royal Caribbean, the worst performer, down about 5%, while Norwegian and Carnival are down about 3%. This after Norwegian announced its biggest new ship order ever yesterday. We will talk to CEO Harry Sommer in an exclusive interview. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Norwegian Cruise Line just placed its largest order in the company's history, ordering 8 new ships to be built over the next 10 years, adding more than 25,000 rooms to its fleet. And this comes after Norwegian's latest report showed revenues in 2023 were up 32% from pre-pandemic levels. And the momentum in travel that's pushing shares up nearly 50% over the past year. But they have struggled a little bit in 2024, down more than 5%. Let's bring in Norwegian Cruise Line CEO Harry Sommer, along with Seema Modi, who joins me here on set. Seema, kick it off.
Deidre, thank you. Harry, it's a pleasure to have you on CNBC today. Stifel analysts are calling Norwegian the biggest growth story in the cruise sector. So walk us through this rationale. Why placing such a large order right now?
First off, ladies, thank you for having me on this afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, we've seen cruise demand in this last couple of periods really at record levels. We're seeing record book positions, record guests traveling, record prices, and it gives us great optimism for the future. You know, with that optimism, you know, we look forward to the future and say, okay, what does the future hold for our three brands? And we think this new ship order, which reflects so new ships across all three of our brands, Regent Seven Sea Cruises, Oceania Cruises, and of course, our main brand, Norwegian Cruise Line, is a reflection of that optimism for the future.
So how do you address these concerns that more ships on the market will lead to an overcrowding of the cruise sector and therefore, you know, put more pressure on prices over time? And that seems to be why the cruise stocks are trading lower today.
I think perhaps people are reacting to the large size of the order. But if you look at it, these ships that we're placing, the 8 ships today, are going to be over the next 12-year period. So our actual compound growth over that period is only 4%, which is actually fairly modest growth considering the robust demand metrics that we've been seeing. In the past, historically, if you look at our financials between 2015 and 2019, for example, we actually were able to grow our capacity at 7% and achieve outsized revenue and EBITDA and free cash flow. Our EBITDA and free cash flow grew by much more than the 7% increase in capacity as we were able to successfully absorb demand and get more efficiencies from bigger ships. And we're sure that that same trend will continue in the future, especially at the unprecedented demand levels that we're seeing today.
Harry, what are some of the changes you anticipate? 8 new ships over the next 10 years. What do you think customers are going to be wanting? Are you changing the design or the offerings that you're going to be offering?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we're constantly looking at our guests' experience on board the ship. We carry something like 50 to 55,000 guests every week across our existing fleet of 32 ships. So we get great input from our guests on what they like, what they value, what they're willing to pay for. And we take all of those things in consideration in our new platforms. All three of our brands will have brand new, from scratch, greenfield platforms that will allow us to deliver excellent guest experiences and excellent financial results.
Zip lines, cabanas, spas, and I know the whole wellness trend is also taking hold for the cruise industry. But Harry, walk us through what the consumer wants right now. We have this CPI report coming out tomorrow where there are concerns that the consumer is starting to pull back with inflation staying stubbornly high.
Yeah, we have seen no consumer retrenchment in any of our demand metrics. Our guests, especially the demographic we're going after, seems to be robust. This trend to look at experiences over buying things seems to be alive and well. And we see robust spend, not just on the actual basic ticket, but on experiences on board, things like spa, like you mentioned, shore tours in the gift shop, our casino. People really enjoy the type of experience. You know, we've seen in the industry, you know, what we call a value gap, that the value that a cruise vacation brings is so much better that when guests get when they are trying to book a land vacation. And I think that value gap, especially in these times where perhaps some of U.S. properties have had a challenge staffing up, we've had no such challenge. Our ships are fully staffed. We with experienced crew members that are providing great experiences to our guests every day. It's that value gap and the experience gap where not only are our vacations less expensive than hotels, but also provide a much better experiences for our guests than the comparable land experiences. It's alive and well and people are seeing it.
Harry Sommer, thank you. And Seema, thanks to you for bringing that to us.
Thank you, Deirdre.
We're going to wrap up the show, but let's get a quick check on markets. Markets are a little weaker in today's session. The Dow Industrials is down about 0.4%. The Nasdaq comp down just about 0.1%. That'll do it for the Exchange. Power Lunch is up next, and I'll join Tyler Matheson for that on the other side of this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.